Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest and hopefully the greatest episode, edition, chapter of Life on Planet Porky. And we're delighted to be with you again. When I say we, I'm, of course, the Porkmeister, Mr. Michael Alan Parry. Alan's my middle name, by the way, in case anybody didn't know. And, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, can I ask you one thing, please, before we start? I'm not joking, but I thought when I saw the Stones starting their American tour with a tribute to their drummer, Charlie Watts, the late Charlie Watts, I honestly thought, pack it in, fellas. I don't think they should have done it. I thought it was distasteful.
Well, yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, but what about if you were one of those Americans who'd spent your hard-earned dollars on a ticket for that gig and that tour was obviously sidelined because of COVID and you've been waiting all that time and you wouldn't have wanted to waste your money. You would have wanted to go and see the Stones.
Would you, without Charlie Watts? Would you really feel... I mean, look, we know that the age of the average Stones fan is about my age. I'm 66, okay? So we're later on in life and we've done pretty well out of life. We're baby boomers and all that. But I don't think I would have gone to that concert. I'd have thought, no, it shouldn't be done. Without Charlie Watts sitting behind those drums, it's certainly not the Stones. I know they've lost members of their groups before. Of the group before. Brian Jones, of course, being the first. And you weren't young enough, I don't think, Leslie Ann, to remember when Brian Jones had to be replaced at the concert in Hyde Park with Mick Jagger wearing a sort of frilly, girly dress, reading out a tribute to Brian Jones, who died at the age of 27. That was acceptable in the first decade of the Stones, but in the sixth decade of the Stones, I thought that when, you know, one of the major players, literally one of the major players, had gone, I thought they should have packed up.
Well, you could say this about so many groups. I mean, is The Who still The Who without...
Well, yeah, but they lost Keith Moon.
Without Don Entwistle. Is it The Who with only Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend? Because you could argue that they shouldn't be doing it either. You can say this about a lot of groups who have lost original members of their lineup.
Yes.
The fact is, if you're as old as the Rolling Stones, you know, you run the risk of losing somebody each time they go out on tour. And I think it's fine, to be honest. As long as people still want to go and see them, why shouldn't they continue to perform?
No, I have to agree. Who am I to stop anybody getting up and doing their act? You know, I like to do my thing when I get back into a studio, radio, podcasting with you, excuse me, or television. So who am I to say that nobody should do it? I don't want to make this a podcast, Leslie Ann, which is dedicated to dead people, but we have lost one of the greatest, greatest English footballers of all time in Jimmy Greaves. And the thing is, you're closely involved in this because your uncle, Cliff Jones, played in the same all-conquering team as Jimmy Greaves, Tottenham Hotspur, White Hart Lane and all that. You must have felt a sort of twinge and a, you know, a bit of regret when you heard that poor Jimmy had passed away.
Well, yes, I did, of course. And God rest his soul. But I was also very moved by the tweet that my uncle Cliff Jones put out, you know, lamenting the loss of him and so on. Yeah, it's sad in one way, but not really sad in the bigger picture way. To me, Jimmy Greaves died in May 2015 when he had the stroke that left him in a wheelchair and with impaired speech and with no quality of life at all. That, to me, 6 years ago, was when we lost him. So I think really a death of this kind has to be seen as a blessing.
Yes, I totally agree. Why on earth Spurs PR people did a picture of Jimmy Greaves on the pitch in his wheelchair about 2.5 years ago to promote something, I can't remember what it was absolutely dreadful decision. Jimmy Greaves should be remembered for the lithe body that he had, for the, you know, the big socks that he picked up with the turnover at the top, blue and white, the Spurs colours, for the white Spurs shirt, for the blue Spurs shorts. And that's what he should be remembered as, not a guy, as you've quite rightly said, who ended up in a wheelchair, barely able to speak.
Yeah, it was awful. We do want to remember him in his dynamic heyday.
Yeah.
And I think those pictures will actually become the ones we will look at.
Yes.
They will become the images of Jimmy Greaves that we hang on to. And, of course, as a great sportsman, that's what he would have wanted as well.
Yeah. No, he certainly would. How did your uncle, Cliff Jones, hang on to life every day for 40 years after cracking alcoholism? Because I once asked Jimmy Greaves that, you know, he came into a radio show I was doing and all that, and he said, don't ask. He said, I don't want you to be reminded of it. It's with me every moment of every day. It must be a terrible pressure in somebody's life.
Yeah, and certainly in the case of my uncle, Cliff, he has a very strong Rottweilerish little wife called Joan, my auntie Joan. Very strong family. They would all go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings together as a family.
Really?
So he had tremendous support. Mm. He and my father were incredibly close.
Yes.
Obviously, we haven't had my dad around for the last couple of years, but they were so close. They shared a bed when they were boys. You know, they were joined at the hip all their lives. And there was great family support. And that's all I can really put it down to.
Yeah.
I mean, Cliff will now come along to a family party, I don't know, someone's birthday we had recently or a funeral, you know, the wake afterwards. And he will stand among us all there with our glass of white wine or whatever. And he's standing there with his Coke or his orange juice. And he's not fazed by the fact that he's surrounded by drinkers. He's gone way past that now.
Yeah.
He has that strength within himself.
Amazing.
And that's the most important thing.
Friend of mine in the business that we work in, who's been a bon viveur or a bon vivant, as David reminded me is the right expression, not bon viveur, bon vivant.
A bon vivant, in fact, because it's French.
Say again.
A bon vivant.
Bon vivant. It's bon vivant, isn't it? I'm talking about, you know, a big happy drinker. We always used to call him a bon viveur. And David, who am I talking about here? David, you know, the great, very good looking French footballer.
Ginola.
Thank you very much indeed for bringing it back to the front of my mind, Miss Jones. David Ginola said, no, Michael, it is not bon vivant, it is bon vivant. You know, I think I've told you before that whenever I've walked into a wine bar with David Ginola, women, their knees buckle, they fall to the floor. He was that good looking. If only I'd been that good looking, but never mind, Miss Jones.
You know what? No, don't regret that, because if you take somebody like Roger Taylor, the drummer in Queen, who's so stunningly good looking in
Pretty
that
Boy. I saw a piece written about him in one of the papers over the last couple of days. Was it Pretty Boy he called himself?
Well, he was just so beautiful with that blonde hair and that sort of come hither look about him. And he has, well, I mean, he hasn't aged very well, let's put it that way. Mm. It's always the ones with the most to lose. You know, if you start out quite sort of average looking, you're losing your looks, because we all do. That isn't going to come as such a big shock, is it?
I have to intervene here, Miss Jones. I don't think you have lost your looks ever. You look to me now exactly the same as you looked 30 years ago when I worked with you on Bridge Street.
Looking at me through your rose-tinted specs again.
I've been out for a meeting today, right, and they've sorted out all sorts of technical things about my podcast, sorry, my, what am I talking about here? Cinnamon Challenge being up for auction tomorrow. And the guy I was talking to said, you work with Leslie Ann Jones? I said, yes. The most beautiful voice I've ever heard. I listened to your podcast just to listen to Leslie Ann speaking. Yes, you have a really huge appeal out there, Miss Jones. Please don't forget it.
Now, I'm happy to hear that. Thank you very much.
Let's talk about something much happier and something you know a lot about, and which has become a bit of a mystery over the last week. Did Elvis hate John Lennon, and did John Lennon hate Elvis? And when did they meet?
They only met them once, in fact. Chris Hutchins, you remember him?
Of course, I remember Chris. Yeah, very well.
With Chris Hutchins, he's still around.
Yeah. Is he? I didn't know that.
He is. He claims to have introduced them. He says that he took the Beatles to Graceland, Elvis's home, in 1965.
Right.
For what turned out to be their very first and last meeting.
Yeah.
John and, in fact, Paul McCartney, all the Beatles were great lovers of Elvis. You know, before Elvis, there was nothing, said John Lennon.
I think he did, didn't he? I think that was his direct quote, wasn't it? Before Elvis, there was nothing,
Yeah, and it was one of those where, you know, people say, never meet your heroes. Should the Beatles have met Elvis? It seems that Presley was irritated by John's anti-war stance. And Hutchins claimed that Elvis had these table lamps in his sitting room in the shape of model wagons, train wagons, engraved with the words, "All the way with LBJ." LBJ being Lyndon B. Johnson.
Exactly, Lyndon Baines Johnson.
With JFK, didn't he? Oversaw much of the Vietnam War. Lennon hated LBJ for raising the stakes in the Vietnam War. And Elvis was this ardent patriot. And it was said, and there's no proof of this, but it has been said, that Elvis Presley later aligned himself with J. Edgar Hoover, who was the then director of the FBI,
Secret
Service in America, and encouraged him to throw Lennon out of the US. So, you know, we don't have any evidence of that. We don't know whether that's true. That could be just a vicious rumor. But it seems to be also that John was disappointed. But where was the old rock and roll Elvis? You know, he was a bit of a sort of film star by then. It was all a bit Hawaiian shirts and jumpsuits and all of that. And John didn't want to meet that Elvis. He wanted to meet the original.
Rock and roll Elvis. So John Lennon, the greatest rock star of all time, and I know that because it said that in the opening to your wonderful book.
on the front cover, in fact.
So that has to be true. He actually got disillusioned, did he, about Elvis not being a rock star anymore and being a bit of a sort of Ponzi film star.
You remember those pictures of John Lennon in his teens, 16, 17? He would be in, you know, the faded jeans, the big leather jacket, the quiffed hair sort of greased back. And he looked very much like a young Elvis. So John Lennon obviously wanted to meet the hero who'd inspired his own rock and roll look. And that Elvis was gone.
Absolutely amazing, isn't it? There we go. We always have to have a story about the Beatles in our podcast. And I just wanted to move on to a very tenuous link with the other great Beatle, the other great songwriting Beatle, Paul McCartney. There's a new programme coming out. It's written by the guy who wrote Downton Abbey. I know you're not a huge TV fan, but Downton Abbey was spectacular, you know, and very successful. And now the same guy, Julian Fellowes, who wrote that, has written a prequel to it. And the prequel, honestly, Leslie, and I've read all the details of it, is fascinating. When the aristocracy in this country were losing all their money in the late 1890s, early 1920s, because they all went broke, you know, in the run-up to the First World War and all that kind of stuff, they had to send their sons over to America to marry very, very rich American women. And one of them was a Mrs. Vanderbilt. Now, I'm sure I'm right in thinking that there's a line in a McCartney song somewhere, "Leave me alone, Mrs. Vanderbilt."
It is. Down in the jungle, living in a tent, you don't need money, you don't pay rent, you don't even know the time, but you don't mind. Ho, hey ho, you don't know the song, do you? It's actually called Mrs. Vanderbilt, and it's from the Band on the Run album, 1973.
Wow, that's
never released as a single.
You knew that word by word. Utterly fantastic.
I must have played Band on the Run a million times. I know the whole album off by heart.
Utterly fantastic. So what I'm saying is that made some of the aristocratic families in this country survive. Vanderbilt was an incredible story. He built the railway network across America. He was worth, in equivalent terms today, about £192 billion. That's how rich these guys were who built America. You know, Henry Ford, Vanderbilt, J.P. Morgan, who invented the banking system. It's just incredible, isn't it, the way that America mushroomed and exploded into the great country it is today.
And what's also so interesting is that this phrase, Mrs. Vanderbilt, has come to mean, it's a generic term for an heiress, a socialite, a sort of society matron, yes. So it doesn't necessarily mean a specific Mrs. Vanderbilt, because I think the one you and I would think of is Gloria Vanderbilt.
Yes, absolutely.
The fashion designer, the artist, and so on. She only died, 2019 she died. She was 95. Good. But it's become sort of symbolic of that status, that kind of woman. Yes, a posh lady, a socialite, hasn't
it? Sure, absolutely. And I think she married the Duke of Marlborough, actually, which is, again, another sign of what the Americans wanted was the recognition, of the great tradition of British aristocracy, and what we wanted was all their money in, the massively expansive and exploding American economy. Talking about people in the aristocracy, by the way, I've just read a piece about Lloyd George, the great Liberal Prime Minister from, I think he got
the only Welshman ever to hold the office of Prime Minister.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Well,
Neil Kinnock nearly got there, didn't he? But he overrated himself. Do you remember that famous rally towards
Kinnockio, as we knew and loved him, yeah.
Yes, that's right. But the famous rally, I think it was in Sheffield, towards the end of the election campaign, he started banging his fist on the deck. Are we going to do it? Yes. Are we going to do it? Yes. Are we going to? Yes. And a lot of people, including Alistair Campbell, my old Fleet Street mate, who was an advisor to him then, said he just overplayed his hand and let John Major sneak into becoming the fourth consecutive winning Conservative Prime Minister. But getting back to Lloyd George, I mean, he was a mad shagger, and I mean a mad shagger.
Mr. Parry, there's this kind of language we want on the podcast.
Well, it's a family show, and I think that's the mildest form of sort of abusive language, if you see what I mean. But he, when he was in Downing Street, he had 32 female servants, and nobody could work out why. He didn't really need
the opposite of a harem, I suppose, isn't it?
It was a harem, it was without a shadow of a doubt, and he was having, multiple physical contact with a lot of his servants all the time. I mean, in a way, I kind of admire a guy like that, but
No. And that's because you're a man. I don't admire that at all. That's horrible. He had a secret life, a double life.
Right.
He was married to his wife, Margaret.
Yes.
He was also in a long-term relationship with his young secretary, Francis.
Right.
And he was cavorting and carrying on with all these other birds behind both of their backs. So he did end up marrying Francis after Margaret died, probably brokenhearted.
Yes.
But there were all these other women. There were stories of aborted love children.
Mm.
And you have to counter that with the fact that, this was a man who came from absolutely no money, had no connections. He didn't have an Oxbridge educational background.
Where did he come from then? He came from a Welsh mining village, literally.
He came from Wales and he had nothing.
Right.
But he had this connection with ordinary people.
Yeah.
And he rose to become one of the most powerful men in the world. So
you
have to sort of offset the shaggeration, if you like, the notorious womanizing, with who he was and what he achieved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, he's legendary, isn't he? Everybody thought that he saved us during the First World War. But I think I'm right in saying he didn't actually come into power until halfway through the First World War, did he?
He shared the honour, though, didn't he?
Of course he did. Of course, yeah. I mean,
This kind of indicates. There's a song with the line that goes, Lloyd George knew my father. My father knew Lloyd George or something like that.
Oh, no, I was about to say that to you. Honestly, Leslie Ann, the only thing I know about it was, well, I remember being a kid of about 6 years of age, and every New Year's Eve, my mum and dad used to have a New Year's Eve party at home. And you won't believe it. Some bloke was nominated it was called First Footing. He had to run out the back door, grab a piece of coal from the coal store that we had in the back shed, right, and then run round to the front of the house and come in through the front door 1 minute past 12 with a piece of blinking coal. It's called First Footing or something. And as he came in, I'm not joking, everybody started singing, Lloyd George knew my father. Father knew Lloyd George. And I thought, I wonder what the next verse is. And the next verse was, Lloyd George knew my father. Lloyd George, they were the only words in the song.
I mean, it sort of indicates somebody who might have put it around a bit, doesn't it? I suppose that lyric. But the funny thing about First Footing, it was supposed to be a tall, dark stranger who rocked up at the front door with a beard.
Yeah, that's
collar.
Right. Yeah.
But there was never a tall, dark stranger to be had. So you always had to use somebody you had in the household and pretend you didn't know them. Mm. My mother once took that way too far because she sent my father outside to get the coal. Yeah. And then he had, as you say, to come round the front, knock on the front door. Yeah. And he was so pissed, my dad, that when he knocked on the front door, she answered it. She refused to let him in and slammed the door in his face.
Too drunk.
Too drunk to be admitted.
That's the way New Year's Eve's were in those days. And do you know what? Yeah. I absolutely remember, I can smell it in my nostrils now, New Year's Eve was the only night of the year we were allowed to stay up till, you know, midnight, you know what I mean? Because we were only little. I think I was about 6 and my little sister was 5 and my elder sister was 7 or something like that, but it was New Year's Eve. I distinctly remember the smell of tobacco, because everybody smoked in those days, okay, and it was pungent around the house, and sherry. Everybody had sherry on their breath, and you know, all these old relatives, you know, aunties were trying to kiss you and all that kind of stuff, and it was horrible. And they all smelt of sherry, and I still can't get that smell out of my nostrils, actually. But there you go, that was many, many years ago. What do you think about old Adele and her new partner? I mean, this is some sort of power couple, isn't it?
Well, he looks quite dishy, actually, old Rich Paul. I'm glad it's not RuPaul, because that would cause other kinds of rumours, wouldn't it?
But
this guy, he seems quite interesting. He's a really successful sports agent.
Mm. He is very good.
Ohio. He's got a company called the Clutch Sports Groups. Clutch spelt with a K.
Yeah.
And he represents players like LeBron James, the NBA star.
Oh, massive. You're talking about massive, massive international stars here. Yes, absolutely.
This guy has got a lot of money, right? And she's got a lot of money. And I think that is the answer. When you get into these relationships, it's a bit like Paul McCartney meeting Nancy Shevel, who was probably not quite as rich as Paul McCartney, but in that same kind of bracket.
Her family had a massive trucking company across America.
So if you've been stitched up by a previous partner, and you know, we know some of the details about Adele's relationship with her previous, Simon, and we know something of what went down with Paul McCartney and Heather.
Yeah.
You know, you've been burned, you've been stung, you've lost a lot of money. The way not to lose the rest of your money is to marry somebody as rich as you. Mm. So it looks as though this might be a match made in heaven for these two.
Yeah, I totally agree. She's so different to the woman we knew who came out with, I think it was 3 successive number one albums and all that kind of stuff. And then really, really took a look inside herself, didn't she, at her life. And I don't recognise Adele in that picture with Rich Paul as the Adele who sung, you know, Skyfall, was it, or the Bond?
She did sing that Bond theme song. Yeah. But I mean, she's literally half the woman she was once was.
Yes, she is.
Put herself on this campaign to lose weight and to get fit, and everybody said, "Oh, it's not the same. She looks different." Well, you know, maybe she wasn't happy as a fat girl. She was a fat girl, you'd have to say.
Yeah,
and she seemed so much larger than life. Do you remember when Jerry Halliwell did the same thing? She was quite a chunky girl in the Spice Girls. And then she...
Yeah, but she was curvy. She wasn't chunky. She was curvy.
She had massive thighs, Mike.
Everybody loved the Union Jack mini dress and all that kind of stuff.
They loved that look. But then she slimmed right down and she became this skinny one. And Adele seems to have gone, right, my relationship failed, I need to change myself, I need to become who I really want to be. Yeah. And that seems to be what she's done, and she's backed this guy. They look very much in love, from the photos at least.
They do.
So good luck to them.
I was going to say, absolutely best luck there. I think they've got 2 mega mansions in some part of Hollywood, Beverly Hills or whatever it is, you know, and that again is a great thing, you know. I never really thought it was that odd when... I'm talking about the film.
Put your teeth in.
Put my teeth in. Yeah, no, I know what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about the horrible little Hollywood producer with the big glasses. He used to play Michael's band in New York. We used to go and see him. Woody. What's his name?
Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, thank you. and his wife, Frank Sinatra's ex-wife, yeah?
Mia Farrow,
used to live in separate apartments around New York. And they said that's what made their marriage work. I've got no time for Woody Allen, by the way. We all know things about Woody Allen, which we'd rather we didn't know.
Okay? Well, exactly. But, I mean, do you remember Nicholas Ball from way back?
And yes, I do.
Hazel. He was married to Pamela Stevenson, who then went on to marry Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
When they were married, they lived in separate but adjoining houses. And they said that was the secret to the longevity of their marriage, was having separate, not only separate bedrooms and bathrooms, but separate houses.
Yeah.
And Joan Collins has said the same thing, that the secret to her happy marriage to Percy is having their own bathrooms.
Oh, I totally agree. I think there's an air of romance if you both say to yourself, look, I'm sorry, I've had a long day tonight, I'm going to bed. But then, you know, the next night you invite your wife or your partner into your room.
Yeah, if you've got enough money to have separate houses. The vast majority of people do not have the funds to live that kind of lifestyle. But, you know, great for anyone who can afford it.
No, I tell you, it's absolutely true. It's like the other thing which I've always dreamed of, and that is having my own pub in my own back garden. You know what I mean? Just to get away from, you know, life in the house and invite a few mates around and a few, you know, female friends, obviously, and just get stuck in. But again, you've got to have the funds. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, I'm going to start pumping myself up a bit here as we talk to our audience here now. We are in the middle of the auction for the sale of my viral video, Porky's Cinnamon Challenge. And I have to say, I am utterly amazed at the response I've had from around the world.
It's astonishing. I'm so thrilled for you. I was out with my three kids the other day and they hadn't seen it. So I pulled it up on my phone and showed it to them and they were falling about laughing.
Yes.
I mean, it has that effect on people, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's the most astonishing thing. How you didn't die, I have to say. I mean, it was a very dangerous thing to do, Mike. I hope you won't do such a thing again.
No, but I didn't know it was dangerous. I mean, my nephew Tom, who put it to me, said, look, come on, get down with the kids. And I said, what are you talking about? Take a tablespoonful of cinnamon. No, he didn't actually. He said, take a teaspoon of cinnamon. So Billy Big Boots me, I said, teaspoon of this. I said, what is it? And we were so unprepared to do the video that my sister Jill, because it was down at her house in Bournemouth, had to search through her cupboard, you know, drawers and find some cinnamon for us.
You searched through your sister's drawers?
My sister's kitchen drawers, right? Okay. And
family share.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so we got this and I said, teaspoonful. I said, I can do more than a teaspoonful. Get me a tablespoon. So we've got a tablespoonful, okay? So I, you know, and you've seen the build up to it. I can do this, no problem at all, to prove that baby boomers, that's my generation, can easily outdo the millennials, which is my nephew's generation, you know. And of course, it turned out as it did. Tom nearly put the camera down halfway through because in those days we didn't use a phone like you'd use now, which has got pitch perfect, you know, reproduction. We were using one of those old Sony sort of flip side cameras, you know what I mean? Handheld Sony flip side camera, you know? And honestly, he said, I nearly had to put it down. I thought I had to save my Uncle Mike's life. I was going to grab him, pour water down his throat, pat his back and try and help him. And I kept indicating with my eyes, no, don't stop, don't stop, don't stop, you know. But anyway, look, the point of the story is, I was invited to put this up for auction and I said, only if it's got charity aspects to it. And they said, yes, that's entirely up to you. I said, fine. Companies now in the United States, and the one we're dealing with is called Origin in San Francisco, are the professional companies who sell viral videos through what's called NFT, non-fungible. Yeah, that's right. And I said, okay, fine. Let's have a go and let's see what we can do. Last week, a friend of mine called Russell Osman, who was a footballer for Ipswich and England, and I know him through Alan Brazil, my great friend who played for Ipswich, right? His son got into this business, NFT auction technology. he painted a picture of a rock, and he took one shot of it. And the idea is that you got to acquire the original, and he put it up on an auction site, the same one that I'm on now, and it was bought for £1.3 million.
Good Lord. I mean, you know, we need to be sitting around having think tanks here.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming up with the next idea.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I thought to myself, what? So you paint a picture of a rock and why would somebody buy that? But apparently it's a Billy Big Balls game now in this world of NFT, and who can grab it first and who can outbid each other. And apparently there's a couple of really successful Iranian investors who are determined to buy as many of the big sort of viral videos as they can get, known them for themselves, so that when they get into their penthouse in New York, they can invite people around and say, oh, you'll probably remember, you know, the Mike Parry, Porky Parry Cinnamon Challenge. You cannot
find it. That's your Iranian accent, is it?
Yeah, that's my Iranian accent. And once it's bought, it's taken down on all of the sites. So it's not on YouTube. You see what I mean? You can't see
it. It's like being an art collector, in fact. It's like, you know, owning the Mona Lisa or something.
It is. And the thing is, even though people could sort of save it on the phone and all that, as somebody pointed out to me when I started discussing all this, they said, look, there is only one Van Gogh irises, but there are thousands of prints around the world which are very good prints, but they're not the original thing. And what you buy here is, Tom, my nephew, as I said, filmed it. You're actually buying the original recording of it in high detail technology. I mean, it looks
being funny, right? Just kind of, you know, being devil's advocate.
Yes.
You can only watch something like that so many times, and the appeal of it would start to fade a little bit, wouldn't it?
Well, I'd have thought that, but I've had texts and emails and communication from people who said that they watch it every day and have done for the last 5 years because it cheers them up.
Every day.
You know, it cheers them up and they have a laugh and a shout and they go in the pub and they show it to their mates and all that kind of stuff. So I really don't know. And the other thing is, as we're talking to our audience here Friday morning, we're only halfway through the auction, and so I can't possibly predict what it will sell for or even if anybody will want to buy it. And it's a charity auction anyway, so the money goes to charity. So I hope we can raise as much as we can. But it's a really unknown world. And as you quite rightly pointed out, if you paint a picture of a rock and somebody buys it, well, that's all very good and very nice, but it's got to appeal to only one individual person who, you know, then might say, that's for me. We sadly talked about the demise of Jimmy Greaves, Leslie Ann, and again, I'll repeat what I said in the first half of the podcast. I don't want to make this a show about people who've sadly passed on, but I was really, really sorry to hear about the death of John Challis, who, of course, was Boycie.
Gutted. I was gutted. I loved him. I grew up on Only Fools and Horses.
Right.
It was something that I was devoted to. I didn't watch a lot of telly as a kid. I don't really watch a lot of telly now.
Yeah.
But Christmas was always a kind of ritual, wasn't it? Only Fools and Horses Christmas special and the Morecambe and Wise show.
Yes.
And so always I had those in the back of my mind. I loved all those characters, Grandad and Uncle Albert. That there's an Uncle Albert from another McCartney song, of course.
Yes. Uncle Albert.
I had a very sweet Only Fools and Horses experience couple of years ago.
Really?
I was up at Wogan House, the BBC radio studio.
That's where Jeremy Vine broadcasts his Radio 2 show. I've been there many times,
That's the one. And I was doing what they call down the lines. You know, so you sit in a studio and you do a lot of interviews with BBC local radio stations all around the country.
Yeah.
And they dial in and they sort of plug you in and you talk about, well, in my case, I was promoting a book. And in between times, if you've got 15 minutes, you go and sit out in the reception area.
Yeah.
And in came this very nice looking, completely bare face, no makeup, no hairdo, nothing, but a very nice looking lady. And she sat down all flustered and she said, oh God, of all the days when you come out with no makeup on. And I suddenly realized that outside the window, there were loads and loads of press, photographers and, you know, all sort of jumping around the big pack and everything. So she's obviously someone, but I'm looking at her thinking, I don't know you from Adam.
Not sure you are.
I said, what are you here for? So she said, oh, I am doing a documentary, a radio documentary. I said, who are you? So I said, I don't mean to be rude, but who are you? She said, oh, I was in this long-running TV series.
Oh, she wasn't Marlene, was it?
I looked at her again and suddenly the penny dropped and I started to cry.
Go on.
It was Gwyneth Strong.
Yeah.
Who played Raquel, not Raquel. What am I talking about? Oh. Rodney's girlfriend.
Rodney's girlfriend, yes.
What was her bloody name? I can't remember.
Raquel.
Gwyneth Strong. No, it wasn't Raquel. That was Del Boy's partner.
Yeah.
What was her name? Oh, goodness.
But she had completely straight black hair divided in the middle of her head and fell down around both sides of her face.
No, she was blonde. She was blonde.
Was she blonde? Oh, she was blonde.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, what was her name? Anyway, I started to cry just because I was sitting stupid, isn't it? Why do you do such a thing? Yeah. So tears are rolling down my face. She started to cry as well in reflection of me. And we're both sitting there crying our eyes out, not knowing why we were crying.
Why was she crying about you?
Because I was crying. And I think it was just that Only Fools and Horses was such a huge, indelible part of our childhood.
Indeed.
It was, you know, when we lost Boise, the same as when we lost Grandad and when we lost Uncle Albert, we lost a member of our own family.
Yeah, you've got to be right,
We need to know her name. I'll find out while you talk amongst yourself.
You please do. And I know exactly who you're talking about. I can't see her now.
What have you got to tell us, Mike, that we don't know already?
Well, no, I was going to say.
Can I ask you a question? Did you really have 260 million views on that Cinnamon Challenge?
It could have been more. It's estimated between 260 and 300 million views. And that will go down when it's sold. It will go down to one.
I can tell you, by the way, who she was. How could we forget this? She was Cassandra.
Cassandra, of course. Absolutely.
Oh, my God. That was such a moment, though, sitting there, bawling my eyes out at the BBC with Cassandra.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's because Only Fools and Horses is part of all of us. And I just, I came away feeling such huge affection for her. And for all of those cast members, you know, imagine when Del Boy dies, God forbid, it's going to be terrible.
God, let's not even think about it, please. Now, what I was going to say is, I was lucky enough to work with John Challis on Jeremy Vine on 5. The great thing about Jeremy Vine on 5 is that, you know, I at the start of every month, I get a list of bookings. That's fine. Yes, okay, I can do that. I can't do that. Sorry, working somewhere else on that day. And we all come together. I usually do about 3 or 4 a month or something like that. But then it's only a few days before, beforehand, you get to learn who you're working with, you know? And they said, John Challis. And I said, John Challis, that rings a bell. Oh, he was Boise. And do you know what? I liked him almost as much in The Green, Green Grass, because that was the follow-up, which was written by the same brilliant lyricist, whose name I'm...
A lyricist writes songs. So what are we talking about? You mean John Sullivan, who wrote Only Fools and Horses,
Of course I do, who wrote Green, Green Grass. And in that one, Marlene was an even bigger character. And do you know
how did it go?
Marlene! And, no, it was more, actually, it was more like this. Marlene! You know, it's kind of, you know, Boise demanding his wife comes to his every beck and call, you know.
I love the line when in the pub and he taps on her shoulder and says, come on, Marlene, let's go home and ignore each other for the evening.
Exactly, for the evening, yeah. But so amazing. I was doing a radio show. We got a caller on the line and the producer came in and he said, this one online claims that she's Marlene from Only Fools and Horses. I said, her name's Sue somebody, isn't it? I think it's
Sue. Yes, Sue. Oh,
Whatever, yeah. But
Sue Holden.
Thank you. And I do not wish to be in any way impertinent or rude to Sue Holden.
No, she's lovely. She's an absolutely lovely woman.
She's lovely. So she came on the show and she said, I just want to talk to you because we've been talking about Only Fools and Horses, you see, because Alan Brazil loves Only Fools and Horses and we've been talking about, you know, last night's episode or something like that, you know, or last week's episode. And she came on and we had a fantastic chat and she was absolutely lovely. So I end up on... at the studios in Gray's Inn Road, ITN, And I can't believe I'm in the green room with John Challis. You know, Boycie, it was just a...
But you want him to be Boycie, you don't want him to be John Challis. That's
no, but he was John Challis, such yeah. a lovely, charming bloke, you know, and when these people are so big on screen and you expect them to be as boisterous, and very often they're not, very often they're the opposite, and he was completely the opposite.
Do you know what's great about a show like Only Fools and Horses?
Yeah.
That it told universal truths about all our lives, about yeah. existence, about the human dilemma. And, yeah. you know, you had great scenes that they were kind of set in humour that you'd be laughing your head off, but the dialogue would convey some universal thing about that we could all relate to. Like that scene when they were, Del Boy and Rodney, yeah. accidentally on purpose trapped in the lift because... Yeah. Rodney was going through a terrible relationship dilemma. I think that Cassandra had lost their baby and yeah. and Del Boy couldn't find a way to talk to and help his brother
yeah.
other than to trap him in a lift, pretend,
yeah.
and get it out of him in that sort of circumstance. And we could all relate to that because we've all had yeah. tragedies in our lives where we haven't been able to communicate.
No, I totally agree.
And there were so many moments like that. Mm. Such a clever scriptwriter, John Sullivan.
Oh,
and a great, great loss to the industry as well.
Oh, I totally agree. Do you remember Sue Everson, feature writer on The Sun?
No.
Okay, well, Sue Everson was chief feature writer on The Sun, and she still does, actually, lives near me in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey. So I got out to see Sue, and we're sitting there, and we both like the sherbet, you know what I mean? Always got a car to take me there and a car to bring me back. And I have to make that clear, Miss Jones. And
I didn't expect you to drive there, for goodness sake.
No, well, exactly. And we're talking about Fools and Horses, and she said, oh, well, that's John for you, isn't it, all over? And I said, oh, do you know him then? She said, oh, yes. She said, I've interviewed him a number of times. I once flew over to America and talked to him there when they did that special in Florida, you know, Only Fools and Horses and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I said, oh, I said, you keep in touch? She said, well, he lives next door. I said, what? She said, yeah. I said, let's go and see him. She said, not really, Mike. You know, we can't just go and barge in on him. And I wanted to, you know, I want to meet this guy, this genius who created.
Well, why didn't you just doorstep him, do the classic journalist hack thing and go knock on his door?
We went round and knocked on the door and he wasn't in. Seriously. I lost my chance to meet
him. I bet she sent him a secret coded message.
Probably saying, you know,
we're going to knock on your door a minute, but don't be in.
That's right. Some half-baked's coming round. You know, he's had too much to drink and he wants to impress you with how brilliant he is as a journalist.
He wants to show you his cinnamon challenge.
No, probably. It was all like that. Listen, I was... we've got to talk about goodness in this show as well as anything else. But I was, again, I'm afraid it's a bit of a downer, but I was very sorry to read about Julia Bradbury.
Terrible, terrible news. Poor girl.
Well, I worked with Julia and she came and did a couple of interviews with me. And then she's writing a book about walking. And I told her about how walking actually saved my life. It literally saved my life after I had acute heart failure, after I had dilated cardiomyopathy, the only thing that kept me going was increasing my ability to walk each week from 1 mile to 2 mile to 3 mile. And she thought it was a fascinating story. And I've written a chapter for her book on walking about that, you know. Lovely, lovely woman. Why do these terrible diseases hit those who least deserve them?
Well, nobody deserves to be hit by a disease, Mike.
Of course not. Of course not.
You know, we can't, it's non-selective. It's random.
Yeah.
That's the nature of a disease. Why has COVID killed certain people and others have escaped? You know, it's not as if nature can make a choice between people who deserve to live more than others. It's it's completely random. Unfortunately, that's what cancer is.
I know, it's absolutely shocking. And talking about women, let's talk about a more upbeat story. I'm sorry. I've worked at Talksport with a lady called Laura Woods, who is a brilliant presenter. She does the breakfast show Monday to Wednesday. She hosts football on Sky. She was taken on by Barry Hearn to front the darts competitions that he does. And last night I switched on the telly. and she was hosting the Ladies International between England and Luxembourg, right? So I took a picture of it and I put it out and said, you know, delighted to see, you know, my great pal Laura from TalkSport fronting up, you know, the woman's football, isn't she brilliant? That tweet has had about 370,000 responses, right? And can you believe that 369,000 of them were very positive, but there's still a misogynistic minority out there who would come back and say, you know, effing useless. Yeah, women don't belong in sport. You know, doesn't know what she's talking about. It really was eye-opening.
Do you know, even my dear mother was having a conversation with her last Sunday. It was something to do with, we were watching something on TV, and she said, I'm sorry, but I still don't think women should play football or cricket.
Right.
I said, why, Mum? I said, I played cricket at school. Bridie, my youngest, she played football at school very successfully.
Yeah.
Why do you think that? Well, it's not right, is it? Those are male games, male domains, and women shouldn't have anything to do with them.
Mm.
And she couldn't explain why. And that was a woman saying it.
Yeah.
I found it quite shocking, and I'm still trying to understand.
But it's a woman of a certain age. It's a woman a generation above you, Leslie Ann, and that's the way they think. My mum used to think like that, to be honest. My mum was appalled that women actually get into a boxing ring and start punching each other. You know, she just couldn't believe it.
Well, Nicola Adams was the first winner of the Ken Jones Award.
Yes, that's right.
Through the boxing writers.
Sorry, I didn't know she was the first winner of the Ken Jones Award, but I knew she broke down a lot of barriers in women's sport, didn't she?
Yes, she was. After my father died, there was an award was generated in his name and his memory, and she was the incipient winner of it. She was the first one to take the prize,
Super, that's absolutely fantastic. Finally, Miss Jones, I read a piece which I'm sure you've read as well, because you read everything like I do. The biggest issue now in divorces is who gets the dog.
Oh, drives you insane. What is that about? Go and buy another dog, you know?
Well, yeah, but if you fall in love with your dog, that's your dog, isn't it?
A dog is a dog. It's an animal. You know, it can't talk to you. People say, oh, dog is a man's best friend. How do you know? That dog inside its head might be thinking, good God, I hate this bastard. You know, I wish I could tell him, but I have to do as I'm told. Otherwise, he won't feed me anymore or kick me out in the street.
Yeah.
But how does anybody really know that that dog is loyal to that person? Surely the dog is only loyal to the person who feeds him.
Do you know what? I think you've got it absolutely nailed on. A dog is only loyal to the person who produces the dog bowl with the food in it, aren't they? And if they know you, that's why they love you, don't they?
You know, I know cats. I say I know cats. I know people who, in inverted commas, have cats.
Yeah.
And it turns out that these cats have about five families who think they own the cat.
Right.
Because the cat goes from house to house to house to
house,
gets fed everywhere it goes, gets loved and petted everywhere it goes.
Yeah.
But it's a tart. That cat goes it goes wherever it's welcomed and fed. And I think in the case of a dog, you know, don't anthropomorphize the animal, which I love that word. You know, we tend to treat animals, in this country we do, as though they are humans, as though they are people and have human feelings and attributes.
Yeah.
They don't. They are animals. Yeah. Get another one.
Yeah, no, you're right. I don't like cats. I hate cats. I think cats are evil. I think they plot.
Evil?
No, they are. Their cats are very
evil. I'm sure they're not.
Cats are evil. They plot against humans. They do.
Oh, they plot, do they? Yeah. They sit around having powwows.
I think so. I read an amazing, I suppose it's called a fact of the night, that whilst humans have to cope with the eventuality of dying, apparently animals don't, because animals don't know one day they'll die. They just expect their life to be the same every day.
Well, they don't have expectations at all because their brains aren't that developed. I think you were reading about Julia Bradbury, and she was talking about... this cruel thing that humans actually know we're going to die because we have intelligence. But no other creature has the level of intelligence that we have, that we know that one day we will have to expect to die.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Thanks for reminding me of Julia Bradbury, you know, because I read all that. But I found that amazing. I would love to be in that position. Because when you get to a certain age, and I'm a lot older than you, Miss Jones, you start thinking about, how am I going to handle the rest of my life? Have I got enough money? Will I be comfortable in my old age? What happens if I get ill? And all those start to you know, sort of start putting pressure on your brain and all that. And I wish we didn't have to do it. I wish humans, sentient beings like animals, didn't know they were going to die. It would make
the thing we don't know is when.
Yeah.
You know, well, in fact, we don't know because it could happen any day. It could happen today, tomorrow. You know, we're in the final third of our lives, I suppose, aren't we? And it could happen any time. We just have to be grateful for what we have and take each day as it comes, but sort of have a loose 5-year plan, a looser 10-year plan, where we might like to be at those stages in our lives, just in case we live that long.
Sure, I totally agree. One last question for you, Miss Jones.
Yes.
Will you ever accept James Bond as Jane Bond?
I don't see why not. Come on. Look, a lot of opposition to the first female Doctor Who, wasn't there? And Jodie Whittaker is now bowing out.
Hang on. Doctor Who was a fairly amorphous character. James Bond was the most virile and toughest man in the world. You can't replace him with Jane Bond.
Did you ever read the Ian Fleming novels?
Yes, I did, yeah. As a kid, I did, yeah.
Would you agree that the character in the novels is not quite the huge exaggeration that we've come to know James Bond as from the silver screen?
Yes, but it was the seed that sprouted and created the James Bond we know. So let me say this to you. How about if Sherlock Holmes suddenly became Shirley Holmes? I mean, you wouldn't have it, would you?
The thing is, you can't really... Okay, I'll take that back, because you can't really change... I know it's a fictional character, but it's a historic fictional character.
He's almost real. James Bond's not fictional anymore. James Bond's real.
No, darling, no. He's a made-up character. He was invented by Ian Fleming.
Hmm. Yeah, well, he wasn't invented, he's created.
He's a historic character, the same as any character in William Shakespeare or Charles Dickens. You know, so you can't suddenly give that character a sex change.
Exactly.
You have to invent another character along the same lines.
That's Miss Jones, you're talking sense. Fantastic, wonderful, there we go. Oh, right, okay, folks, we've run over time a little bit here, but it's always a great pleasure to discuss these things with Miss Jones, the rock chick writer extraordinaire. Miss Jones, thank you very much today. And to our audience out there, thank you for joining us. And we'll be back with you again very soon.
It seems to be also that John was disappointed. But where was the old rock and roll Elvis? You know, he was a bit of a sort of film star by then. It was all a bit Hawaiian shirts and jumpsuits and all of that. And John didn't want to meet that Elvis. He wanted to meet the original.
That's amazing.
Rock and roll Elvis.
John Lennon, the greatest rock star of all time, and I know that because it said that in the opening to your wonderful book.
on the front cover, in fact.
Yeah, so that has to be true. He actually got disillusioned, did he, about Elvis not being a rock star anymore and being a bit of a sort of poncy film star. I said, let's go and see him. She said, not really, Mike. You know, we can't just go and barge in on him. And I wanted to, I want to meet this guy, this genius who created...
Well, why don't you just doorstep him, do the classic journalist hack thing and go knock on his door?
We went round and knocked on the door and he wasn't in. Seriously. I lost my chance to meet
him. I bet she sent him a secret coded message.
Probably saying, you know,
we're going to knock on your door a minute, but don't be in.
That's right. Some half-baked's coming round. You know, he's had too much to drink and he wants to impress you with how brilliant he is in the journalist.
He wants to show you his cinnamon challenge. Not
No, probably. It was all like that. I don't like cats. I hate cats. I think cats are evil. I think they plot.
Evil.
No, they are.